This is Whitley Strieber, and you have made a courageous choice. You're listening to Dreamland, a truly free, non-commercial voice on the internet. And from 22,500 miles in the sky on 1.FM and the Global Star Communications Radio Network, we say it like it is. We take you where others will not take you. Dreamland, welcome to the edge of the world. And you better be excited about this program because it is really special. William Henry is making some major, major breakthroughs in our understanding of some things that have been lost for a long time but have never been more important. He's also going to be appearing live Saturday morning from 10 to 11 a.m. Pacific time in the chat room. That's the subscriber chat room. Subscribers, don't miss this. And if you're not a subscriber, well, it's time to join up. $11.95 for 3 months brings you things like the chance to talk personally with someone like William Henry. Listen up now. This is really an incredible story that he is going to tell us on Dreamland. Jesus performed all of his miracles with a magic rod or wand that produced a ring or vibration that altered reality. Well, who would say something as radical as that? None other than our resident co-host, William Henry, here as the interviewee today, under his hat as an investigative mythologist. He has created an incredible new DVD set called The Lost Secrets of Jesus, The Wand and the Ring. And you think that Jesus was simply identified with the cross? Well, think again. Some incredible and extraordinary research has been done. Get ready for a great ride. Welcome to the show, William.
Thank you, Whitley. It's great to be here as your guest.
Well, William, this new two-DVD set extends the effort you have been making really to restate and perhaps go back to a type of Christianity that is very, very different from what we know today. A reference, it refers to ancient technology and goes back beyond Christianity to the earliest known remains. And I want to start ruins. I want to start with the Osirian, which has always fascinated me. It's a place you've actually been. This is a very, very old temple in Egypt and perhaps was built at a time when the technologies that became known as Osiris and eventually were utilized by Jesus were understood. Could you describe the Osirian to us and what it was like to actually be there?
Oh, certainly, yeah. It is truly one of the most mysterious places on the entire planet, even rivaling the Giza Plateau itself. In fact, Egyptologists such as John Anthony West and others have believed that this temple is as old as 10, perhaps even 12,000 years old, maybe even older than that. They believe this because of the incredible red granite blocks that compose this temple, the Osirian, which sits at behind the temple of Seti at Abydos in Egypt. And it's at the Osirian where many believe you find the actual tomb of Osiris, of the Egyptian god of resurrection. And when we go there, what you're finding is that you're at a place that was a place of continuous pilgrimage for over 3,000 years in the ancient world. And to me, it has the feel of like a technology center. Because when you look at some of the etchings on the exterior walls of the Osirian, and then when you see what was done inside of Seti's temple at Abydos, which is mostly dedicated to Osiris, you find the most incredible examples of ancient technology that you're going to find anywhere. Many people have probably heard of the famous glyph that resembles a modern-day helicopter and a modern-day tank. Those glyphs are found on the walls at Abydos. But my specialty has been to focus on the Osiris pillar, which was called Jacob's ladder. It was called the ladder to heaven. It was called the tower, which means the bond between heaven and earth. And I've latched onto that as sort of the centerpiece of my research and view it almost like a Christmas tree that has to be the focal point of all these mysteries. And what my research ends up being is sort of like the decoration that goes on that tree.
Exactly. But now we live in a situation where something has changed and changed profoundly. There are two Christianities. The Christianity before the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD and another Christianity afterward, a disastrous Christianity that depicts, as you say in your DVD, a master-slave relationship between man and God. Describe what might have been before then.
In my research on what they call primitive Christianity, I mean, that's the term that scholars give to it. It's actually the original revelation that Jesus and the disciples were formulating. What we have, my research shows, is a situation where you have a group of incredible researchers who were scouring the temples of Egypt, of Iran, of Iraq, of India, and assembling the largest collection of data on how to kickstart or how to ignite latent capabilities within our DNA. They were interested in how it is that an ordinary mortal can transform themselves into a being of light. And it's primarily, I believe, at Abydos where they found their greatest inspiration. And I say that because at Abydos, not only do we see the examples of the incredible Osiris device, the bond between heaven and earth, in other words, some sort of a ladder or stairway to heaven, but we also find examples, incredible examples, of the Egyptian god of divine magic and alchemy, Thoth, or Tahuti, as he's also known. And inside of Abydos, the depiction of Tahuti shows him raising Osiris from the dead with a key of life in one hand and a set of caduceus rods or wands in his other hand. And what we find is that the earliest Christian art up until about the year 150 AD, as exemplified in the catacombs of Rome, we see Jesus raising Lazarus with an identical rod or wand in his hand. And there's no question in my mind and among others who have studied this that what we're looking at here is Jesus taking over or assimilating the knowledge that was once possessed there at Abydos, especially exemplified by Thoth, and demonstrating his mastery of that knowledge.
And now, however, is the actual raising of the dead body, in other words, the bringing of Lazarus back to life, metaphorical or physical? In other words, was it an awakening that was taking place? The rising of Kundalini in Lazarus, perhaps? Or was it a dead body that was being brought back to life?
Well, I think most of it, as we can understand it, is metaphorical, that what we're talking about here is clearly an initiation. John is often referred to as the actual Lazarus figure, and the word John becomes the root for our word gen, which we find in genetics, we find that in Genesis, we find it in gnosis and other terms that refer to wisdom. So it's very possible that what we're describing here with this rod or wand is the transmission of a certain body of knowledge that lifts a person or awakens a person from the sleeping state or the quote-unquote dead state. In this line of thinking, all of us on this planet are essentially the dead, and it's when we go into the afterlife that we actually join the living. Now, that said, you find an incredible interest in this whole idea of literal physical resurrection and immortality among the researchers of this period. And one of their key figures that they researched was not just Thoth of Egypt, Tahuti of Egypt, or Hermes of Greece. They also keyed in on Osiris and this magical garment, this seamless garment of light that Osiris was given by Isis and by Thoth, that the ancient Egyptians referred to as his crossed garment. They spelled it K-R-A-S-T, his crossed garment. And you note that that word cross sounds like the way we pronounce the word Christ here in Tennessee, where I live. And I think that that's the origin of this whole idea of Christianity's seamless robe, the coat of many colors, all of these references to the initiates awakening and then putting on a new garment of light. By the way, this is why we dress our children in new clothes at Easter. It's because of this original Egyptian tradition of literally putting on new clothes made of light.
Now, you describe Osiris as being not a person, but a device. What sort of device do you mean?
Well, this comes from the ancient Egyptians themselves. They clearly portrayed Osiris in two manners. They portrayed him as a mummified human being, the Lord of Eternity, the Lord of the Field of the Blessed, or the Dimension of the Blessed. But they also clearly portrayed Osiris as an instrument, as a tool that looked like an antenna mounted to what we would readily identify as the early model for the biblical Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant was used as a communications device. Some people believe it was actually an energy device and possibly even a weapon system. I think that the Osiris device was used for a peaceful purpose. This is indicated because almost every time it's seen in ancient Egyptian art, individuals are offering not carcasses to this device, to this symbol of their god. They're not offering humans in sacrifice to this god. They're offering food to this device or symbol of their god, indicating that this device was used for peaceful purposes. It was used to knit heaven and earth together, and even in our contemporary understanding, perhaps to drill holes in space, to open holes in space so that individuals who were initiated could then go through those gateways in space and dwell for eternity in the field or the dimension of the blessed.
Now, this dimension, this is really what your work is about, is recovering our ability to enter this state or dimension. Where is it, William, in your mind?
Well, it's described as an otherworldly realm, as a dimension right beside our own. And this is what's got me so excited about the research that's being done at CERN right now and elsewhere, and our understanding of this whole idea of parallel dimensions.
Tell us about CERN, and what is CERN?
At CERN, which stands for the Center for European Nuclear Research, you have scientists gathering together from 80 countries who are working on a large circular tunnel, a ring, a 17-mile circular ring, in which they're going to start speeding, but at the end of 2007, they're going to start speeding protons at near the speed of light so that they will smash into one another and will enable us to see into the original secrets of and mysteries of matter itself. They plan on duplicating the conditions that existed at the time of the Big Bang and literally answering the question of what happened at the moment of creation.
Now, they expect to find the Higgs boson, the fundamental building block of the universe. If they don't find it, if it's not there, it means, interestingly enough, that the universe is built in some way that we do not understand at all. What do you think the odds are that they will or will not find the Higgs boson based on your understanding of the universe?
Well, I think that they're very close. And by the way, I'm planning on visiting CERN this summer. And before I go there, I'm going up to Fermilab in Chicago to take the tour of the particle accelerator there. And while on this subject, it's interesting to note that there are two kinds of particle accelerators. There are those that are linear or rods, and there are those that are circular or rings. This became the subtitle of my presentation, The Lost Secrets of Jesus, the wand or the rod and the ring, because over and over again in early Christian art, he's shown either with this rod in his hand or with a ring, a chakra of power that he used to perform his miracles. So based on the bravado of what you're hearing coming out of these facilities, I think there's a very good chance that they're actually going to be able to solve these mysteries within the next probably 1 to 3 years. The scientists that you read about that are involved, you think of them as being very conservative, but all of them can barely contain their glee and their excitement for this project when you read the quotes. And so based on that, I think that they are very close to actually being able to crack open these seeds of creation and tell us the information that's been lost to us that I think is going to enable us to go from cosmic kindergarten, metaphorically speaking, into first grade.
So Subscribers don't miss Ann Strieber interviewing William Henry about the meaning of Christianity and how Christianity was changed and what was taken from us and what we need to regain. It's a fascinating interview in the subscriber section. We'll be right back. I'm going to be on Coast to Coast AM on the night of Saturday, June the 9th at 10 o'clock from 10 to 11, and I'm going to be offering something very special. I'm going to be offering autographed copies of the Gray's T-shirt. There are about 150 of these made, and they were made for sales reps. And these copies that we have are the only ones that are autographed. They're real collector's items. All you need to do is go to unknowncountry.com and click on the subscribe tab. Become a subscriber in order to get one of these if you are among the first 50 people to try, because we have already given away 100 of them to our current subscribers. So get in on the fun. Join unknowncountry.com today. $39.50 gets you a year and, if you're lucky, one of these neat T-shirts. Later in the program, don't miss Linda Howe. She's got proof that crop circles aren't man-made.
You're listening to Whitley Strieber's Dreamland Online.
This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. I'm talking to William Henry. His website, williamhenry.net, is phenomenal new 2-DVD set, The Lost Secrets of Jesus, available from the unknowncountry.com store, and whatever price it is a steal. Believe you me. William Henry's incredible new DVD. And subscribers, don't miss Ann Strieber and William Henry in the subscriber section. William, when we left the air, we were talking about the CERN Super Collider, and one of the things that you made reference to is that there are two types of super colliders. One is shaped like a tower. The other is circular, like the wand and the ring of Jesus. Now, could you tell me what the two different types of super colliders are capable of doing? What is the difference between them?
You know, I don't know the exact difference between the rod type and the ring type. They both ultimately are used to slice and dice matter. And that's part of why I'm going to these places, is so that I can look at the linear accelerator at the Fermi lab and then be able to compare it with the ring type accelerator that they're building at CERN. So I'll be able to more clearly answer that in just a couple of months.
Now, OSIRIS did not have a rod and a ring, did he? That's not part of his symbolism.
OSIRIS most definitely had a rod. He was portrayed as an enlightenment pillar that was operated or played, if you will, by ISIS. And
yeah,
the analogy,
it's got to be very carefully understood here, folks, that we're looking at something really remarkable. OSIRIS was not a person. OSIRIS is clearly in the reliefs and artwork that William shows in his DVD, a device. And interestingly enough, this device is played by a woman, it's manipulated or run by a woman. And this is consistent across all of history, that a woman and the female element is the enabling element. This is what seems to turn it on. Now, why is that, William? Because we have Mary Magdalene and Jesus. We have Jesus and his mother, Mary. We have OSIRIS and ISIS. We have, I believe, in the Sumerian traditions also, I'm forgetting the name of the goddess who...
Ishtar.
That's right, Ishtar. Now, what is going on here? Because, I want to relate this to... I know it's a complex question. Please forgive me. I want to relate this to Kundalini energy and the rising of Kundalini energy in the body and what the energy in that pillar might have been.
Right. Well, let me preface this by saying that when you look at the hieroglyph of OSIRIS, which is the logo that I've adapted for my business card, and you see it in my books, it shows a shrine-like symbol that looks like the Ark of the Covenant that is flanked by two power pillars called Tet pillars. Then there's a third symbol in Osiris's hieroglyph, which is a pillar with two tablets sitting on top of it that has a serpent levitating within it. And when you add all those symbols together, it creates or sums up to the Osiris device. So when we're looking at Isis standing next to Osiris, we have to always figure that there's a serpent of some kind levitating within that pillar or tree. And once we make that connection, it's easy for us to see that, okay, Isis is Eve. This serpent is the serpent of wisdom, and we're obviously talking about the tree of knowledge here. And when the serpent spits whatever energy emerges from it, that becomes the forbidden knowledge, the forbidden fruit. And we notice in these reliefs of the Osiris device, once again, they are serving fruit to it, symbolic of this being an instrument of peace. This is why I believe that this instrument is often seen portrayed being played, and I would go along with that term played, by women, because the women were using this knowledge that's embodied within the symbology of this device for peaceful purposes, as opposed to using this incredible knowledge for making war or for destruction. And on this idea of this instrument being played, the analogy that I like to make is that of the modern-day Les Paul guitar. The modern-day Les Paul guitar is a stringed instrument that created a revolution in our time when rock and roll musicians like Jimmy Page and others started playing this guitar. There is a person named Les Paul, who's a world-famous jazz musician, who gave his name to this instrument. It's possible in this analogy that there was a person named Osiris, probably a being from Sirius, because from Sirius is where the Egyptians told us that Osiris hailed. So again, it's possible there is a person named Osiris, but more than likely what the Egyptians understood was that Osiris was an instrument, a device that, very much like the modern Les Paul guitar, is an instrument that was used to create tones and vibrations that brought about a peaceful state. Abydos was one of the most ancient oracular sites. And these oracular sites were known as places of healing because of the energy or the vibration that emanated from these places. And I think that when the Osiris device was in operation at Abydos, it created this incredibly rich and beautiful civilization around it that was entirely peaceful.
I want to change direction here for a moment. What is going to seem initially like an unexpected direction, but it really isn't at all. I want to move forward to the 20th century and to work off of your reference to the dark uses of this power. In 1914, something happened on this planet that has been probably the greatest catastrophe ever to befall the human race. On June the 28th, 1914, at 11 o'clock in the morning, the Archduke Franz Ferdinand of Austria and his wife were killed in Sarajevo by a man called Gavrilo Princip. He was a Bosnian nationalist and a member of an organization called the Black Hand. His shooting of that gun unbalanced an enormously complex system of human interaction known as the imperial system at that time, and caused all of these different empires to start fighting with each other. From that bullet, that one bullet, to what you refer to in the DVD of the battle between Christian George Bush and the Muslim Osama bin Laden, is an unbroken chain of human misery. And now we have again
in Bush and Bin Laden, two people who are trying in every way that they can to induce another great battle, this time a nuclear battle. And they're close, William. William, what is the energy, the dark energy that's at work here? It's one energy, and it starts with one bullet, a few grains of gunpowder, a tiny beginning. But what is it?
That's a really tough question. I think it's
I knew it would be a little bit difficult.
You know, since we're talking about Sirius, I mean, I've become a very big subscriber to the line of research that was put forward by Walter Cruttenden and his Lost Secrets of Myth and Time, and this idea that we go through these ages of
yes, and subscribers,
light.
By the way, you can listen to Walter Cruttenden's interview on Dreamland. It's archived in the subscriber section. Go ahead, William.
And as he says, we go through these periods of light and these periods of darkness when we're in alignment with these enlightenment energies, if you will, that are coming to us from our relationship with Sirius. And at times when we're not in that alignment, this is when we go through these periods of dark ages. And this is part of the reason why it was so important to preserve this knowledge about the Osiris device, because it clearly resembles an antenna. And the idea is that if Osiris originally came from Sirius, then if we're allowing this notion, as is upheld by so many different researchers, that literal physical amphibious beings originally came from Sirius and brought their technology with them, then this antenna, this Osiris device, this instrument, could be capable of tuning into those enlightenment particles during these dark phases. And that's one of the purposes for this device. And it's unknown or uncertain how close we are to re-entering those stream of enlightenment particles, but it's clear that during the intermittent phases that individuals do have the ability to overcome the base level of darkness that is on this planet that allows instances such as you described to trigger not only just two world wars, but now the third world war that we're in the midst of presently.
Oh, they're very close. The government has, the president just last week issued a presidential executive order through Homeland Security directing the federal government to prepare for a surprise nuclear attack on Washington. And that means that they have intelligence estimates suggesting that this could happen. That's why they are preparing for it. And it is absolutely terrifying because, of course, the decapitation of the United States would be on an even larger scale, very similar to the murder of the Archduke, in that the murder of the Archduke eventually deranged the whole system of treaties that held European peace together at that time. The decapitation of the United States will be an even more profound and indeed possibly a permanent derangement, in the sense that then they can say, well, we have killed Washington and we have bombs in London, in Paris, in Berlin, wherever they want to say, and you must do our bidding or we will kill you too. The end of the Western world, therefore, is upon us. A much larger outcome. But then again, a bomb is larger than a bullet. How do you react to that?
Well, I totally agree, and it goes with this whole idea that we're in this season of prophecy fulfillment here as we march up to 2012. I've been revisiting the Lewis Ginsburg's recollection of the Jewish legend about the return of the Messiah and how Elijah will return and lay the rod before the Messiah at the Temple of Jerusalem. And they have a to-do list of some of the other things that this Messiah and Elijah are going to do, among which is something that both George Bush and Osama bin Laden both appear to be very interested in, which includes recovering the Ark of the Covenant and some of the other holy vessels that go with the rebuilt Temple of Solomon.
Now, we'll talk in just a minute with William about why he knows or feels that they are even concerned about this at all. We're also going to talk about another thing, which is energy, the Sirius energy, the energy from Cygnus X3, energies from the center of the galaxy. What do all of these energies mean, and why are so many people talking about so many different energies? We'll get through all of this after the break. The subscribers are going to be listening to Ann Strieber and William Henry in a very extraordinary and profound discussion, basically about the relationship between real Christianity and the use of these energies, because Jesus was not telling us that he was special and we had to just worship him. He was telling us how to do something, and that information and knowledge is being rapidly recovered. We'll be right back.
Later in the program, Linda Howes got a crop circle story from the U.S. that is going to really stun you.
This is Whitley Strieber, talking to William Henry. We're back. William Henry's website, williamhenry.net. His new DVD, The Lost Secrets of Jesus, a fabulous two-DVD set. I love it. I have to just tell you that. It is William Henry at his absolute best. It's available from the unknowncountry.com store. I don't know what the price is, but it's whatever the price is, get this. Do not miss this. This is very, very valuable information. It's food for the soul. If ever such a thing could exist, it's in this DVD. Now, William, you mentioned in the DVD, and you mentioned a few moments ago as well, that there is evidence that Osama bin Laden and George W. Bush would both like to find the Ark of the Covenant. What is the evidence that they have an interest in this?
Well, we've been tracking this whole notion of Osama bin Laden and his apparent belief, or his belief certainly, in the return of the Islamic Mahdi, who will be working with the Prophet Jesus. And one of the things that the Mahdi has on his to-do list is to recover the Ark of the Covenant. Based on that, we can begin to speculate that any opposing force, recognizing that this is who bin Laden thinks he is or who he's working on behalf of, is going to take the steps to prevent him from recovering that Ark of the Covenant and ultimately destroying the temple, or the rebuilt temple in Jerusalem. So that's the first step towards it. But then it's also this notion that the prophet Jeremiah indicated that the Ark of the Covenant may even have been taken to Babylon, and which is, of course, is present-day Iraq. And as you know, I've spent quite a bit of time going back into the late 90s following Saddam Hussein's interest in these ancient artifacts and the understanding that all those who are the power players on this planet right now recognize that we are in this season of prophecy, and they are seeking to control the ultimate fulfillment of them. One other thing I wanted to mention about this to-do list of Elijah and the returning Messiah is that they're charged with shining the primal light as it shone before the week of creation. They're charged with shining or bringing knowledge about the primal light as it shone before the week of creation. That's exactly what CERN proposes it is going to do. They're going to recreate the conditions that existed at the time of the Big Bang, so that we can reveal knowledge about the primal light which shone before the week of creation. And so here's yet another example of how things are beginning to accelerate and quickly here. And to refer back to what's going on at CERN, keeping a close eye on that simply because it falls into this whole category of what the ancient Jewish legend says was to happen during these times.
So you say that we are in some sort of an end time.
I definitely think so, and as you watch the actions of what we've been, of Bush and others, and what we've been doing in Iraq, it's all been as if they're following a script. Babylon had to be rebuilt in the 1980s by Saddam Hussein because the Bible says that this rebuilt Babylon is going to be destroyed at the time of the second coming of the Lord. And so in that sense, Saddam Hussein was fulfilling biblical prophecy. And when we went into Iraq, I have little question in my mind that one of the number one or two things on our list was to recover the ancient knowledge that Saddam Hussein had readily assembled for us so that we can take control of this ancient knowledge and the sites represented there in Iraq.
Now, this, of course, it always works badly for the dark side. In other words, it never works out as they anticipate, and of course they never think of themselves as being evil. But it is evil. I mean, Saddam Hussein was evil, but I don't think that the people who gained this information by cloaking their theft behind a mask of looting and apparent incompetence are any better? Are they? Or is did they...
No. And it's the
just
reason
one power monger stealing from another power monger.
That's demons, all it is.
Demons ripping ripping things out of each other's hands.
And so, it's because they're motivated by the love of power, not the power of love.
Exactly. That's the whole difference. But the problem is this: where is this now, and can it hurt us?
Yes, it can hurt us because ultimately, but maybe not necessarily in the physical sense. If Osama bin Laden could get a hold of the Ark of the Covenant and prove that it is not a copy of the Ark, but the original Ark, he has essentially taken control of the Jewish mind, because that is such an important symbol of the covenant between the Jews and Yahweh. Christians don't uphold these relics as much as the Jews do, but it's still an important part of Christian belief and this idea of the Ark of the Covenant and other artifacts such as this. And so when Saddam Hussein, going back to him, gains control of this ancient knowledge that can potentially drop a bomb on the Christian mind in terms of its understanding of how its history has been presented to us, that's very dangerous information, and it can begin to erode Western civilization simply by proving that many of the traditions that we uphold are simply fables, or taking control of them and starting to rewrite the story by showing that, in fact, yes, Allah is a superior God to the Israelite God Yahweh, or the Christian God Jesus Christ.
Of course, for somebody who thinks all of these gods are essentially a reflection of the powers of ancient technologies that we have lost track of, it's a little hard to see them fighting over whose God is better, in the sense that I guess people fight over whether or not a Mercedes is better than a Volvo or something.
That's the point, is that they've got us misdirected over here, focusing on the minutiae of the tiny players on the stage, as opposed to looking for, which is what the original Christians were doing, was looking for the knowledge that will enable us to transform ourselves as beings into an angelic realm or an angelic race, and actually leave this place and leave it better than we found it.
You know, William, I've often talked about a time years ago when I was with one of Andrew's friends, taking him to meet his dad in New Jersey, and we briefly drove through what appeared to be another universe in a car, in a Jeep. And we're going to take off for a minute and take a little break in a couple minutes, but when we get back, I'm going to ask about this other dimension and where it is and how to get there, and we'll get into the Kundalini energy at that point. We'll be right back.
One of the great things you can participate in through Mercy Corps that makes a huge difference is microfinance. Did you know that an average person in a place like Afghanistan lives on $2 a day? Your contribution of $50 or $100 or $200 can make an enormous difference. It can change lives in a country like Afghanistan. A small loan that no bank would ever give a little guy working a street corner market. Well, you can give him that loan and make him a new man. You can change not only lives in this generation, but in many generations to come, by setting someone up as an entrepreneur who is struggling to make pennies fit together. Give him $100. Give him a new life. Go to mercycorps.org, click on Afghanistan, and find out more.
You're listening to Whitley Strieber's Dreamland Online.
One thing about online subscriptions a lot of people don't like is they auto-renew. Well, we have a much more sophisticated system now our subscriptions will auto-renew if you want, or if you don't want that, you don't have to have it. You can simply uncheck the auto-renew box when you sign up, and you will not auto-renew. Instead, you'll get a convenient expired notice if you try to log in after your subscription has expired with a simple click-through button that will take you back to your account, and you can resubscribe again if you wish. It's as simple as that. Subscribe to UnknownCountry.com today. We give you absolute control over your subscription. You know, for a powerful, in-depth discussion of the real energies that Jesus was trying to teach us about, do listen to Ann Streber interviewing William Henry in our subscriber section, and get William's new DVD, The Lost Secrets of Jesus. We're getting somewhere very, very serious. A breakthrough is in the process of being made by William Henry at the lead and a number of other investigators. We're beginning to understand who and what Jesus actually was. Now, I will say this. I've received a number of emails from people saying, what is this wand? When was Jesus ever shown, depicted with a wand in his hand? And William, would you tell us that exactly? Because he has in his DVD numerous depictions of this. And so would you tell us a little bit about the depictions of Jesus with the wand and when they started and when they stopped? And then we'll go on.
Sure. I have probably amassed the largest collection of these images that you'll find anywhere, and they're all in the presentation, Lost Secrets of Jesus.
And it's quite amazing, folks. It's just one after another. It's just astonishing. But go ahead.
Yeah. The first one that I ever found came from the Vatican Museum, and it's dated to around 150 A.D. And in this bas-relief, you see Jesus and Mary Magdalene together. She's anointing his feet. Jesus has this rod or wand in his hand, and he is raising Lazarus from the dead. He's portrayed as a Roman-looking person with short, curly hair and no beard. Many of these depictions of Jesus with the rod and the wand came from Rome, starting at around the year 70 A.D., and after about 150 to 170 A.D., they simply disappear. Part of the reason why we see these images, and by the way, he's not just raising Lazarus in these depictions, he's also turning water into wine, he is turning the loaves into fishes. All of the miracles are performed with this rod or wand in hand. And it's easy to say that the reason that he's portrayed this way is to connect him with Moses, who also had this rod or wand, using it to strike the rock out of which the water flowed, to part the Red Sea. The rod or wand is a symbol of their mastery over the elemental forces of this planet or this plane. And what I've also noticed, though, is that there's this Egyptian connection, and this is why I think these images cease to exist, because when you put the images side by side of Jesus raising Lazarus beside Thoth raising Osiris, you can't tell the difference between the two. And it's either that the early Christian artists cut and pasted or copycatted these Egyptian images, or Jesus was taking over or assimilating the knowledge that was attributed to Thoth, and these images demonstrate his understanding of this knowledge. Either way, it's important to note that that branch or rod in his hand, the wand, is a branch from the Tree of Life. And the Tree of Life is clearly the Osiris device. And this is how I connect up Jesus with the Osiris device. In fact, I show in the presentation how the Knights Templar also made a depiction of the true pillar or cross of crucifixion that contains exactly the same symbolism as the Osiris device, indicating their belief that they connected the Osiris device with the pillar or cross of crucifixion.
Now, this gets us to another view of this energy.
that the cross of, you mentioned in your DVD that there is a the offerings that are made to the Osiris device are always food. In other words, it's not dead animals is were being offered in the temple in Jerusalem. It's not dead people as were offered in Mesoamerica. It is simply food. And tell us a little bit about the kind of person we need to be in order to begin to use and have this extraordinary energy inside us.
Well, one of the most basic understandings that comes along with the rod and the ring is that the rod is obviously a phallic or male symbol, and the ring is a female symbol. It's a symbol of wholeness. It's a circle. It represents 360, a circle, whole or holiness. And so from that, what we have to really begin with is this idea that we have to, within ourselves, achieve a balance or a unity of our own inner male and female side. A lot of us have awareness that we have a male and a female side. We might think of it as our logical side and our intuitive side. However you want to image it, it's achieving that balance, getting both sides of ourselves saying yes to our higher spiritual growth is the key, because most of us have been trained to spend our time saying, one part of us often will be saying yes and the other part will be saying no, and when that's happening, we're not going anywhere in our spiritual growth. So the very basic place to begin is to begin to say yes to your higher spiritual growth and to see that saying yes in that way is going to create greater protection and greater prosperity for us than maintaining that place where that male side, who feels like his primary role or responsibility is to protect or provide the inner female and protect her by keeping her alone. Instead, what that male side has to see is that actually stepping out and embracing some of these new ideas and this higher form of spirituality is not going to create ridicule in our lives. It's actually going to create greater protection and greater prosperity for us.
Now, William, I know that there are other universes, parallel universes, or something, because I went into one.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a physical, very real, very physical place. And it was a place so real that it had streets that a car could go down, even a car from another universe, which is what I was in. And naturally, very disturbing experience. And something kind of sinister about the place, maybe only because it was so quiet, I don't know. But where might I have been in view of your research? Where might this be? Could it be that we somehow went through a wormhole? Or were we in a parallel universe? And to add to this, this happened near the Paramus Mall in New Jersey. And after I published Breakthrough, which contains the story, I received a couple of letters from people who had worked on the Paramus Mall who said that balls of light used to come up out of the ground while they were digging the foundation. So how do you react to this? Could it be that passage between universes is literally, physically possible if you know how to do it?
I truly think it is, Whitley. And, in fact, that's my new course of research is following the stories of, well, Jesus' resurrection is a really good example of beings that are able to toggle between the worlds, that can apparently leave this world and then come back into it at will. We interviewed Catherine Dees about her book, Om Seti's Egypt.
Yes.
And in the chronicle of Dorothy Eady or Om Seti, about Seti himself also having this capability of being able to come into this realm and take her into the realm, the field or dimension of the blessed where he presently dwells. And so haven't got enough expertise in exactly how this happens, but what I am doing is making a really incredible research study right now on those who actually are able to do that, and that will be the subject of my next book that will be out later this year. So I'll have more on that by then, because it clearly is not a an anomalous kind of a thing. It's something that all of us should be able to learn how to do. We just simply have been told otherwise by those, the religious and political caretakers, who don't care to share this true understanding with us about what's actually capable within our bodies and our minds.
What we are actually capable of, yes. And incidentally, subscribers, you can listen to me interviewing Hani El-Zaini, who was the co-author of the Om Seti book, and he actually knew Om Seti and knew her for 40 years. And it's absolutely amazing to hear this archaeologist talking about these impossible events of this woman, an English woman, who styled herself as Om Seti, said she was a reincarnation of an ancient Egyptian, and in addition to that, you think, oh, that's pretty far-fetched, she could find archaeological sites, and he will tell you how it felt to be with her when she uncovered sites that nobody knew existed and described them in detail before they were excavated. Awesome, amazing stuff.
And to continue that, Whitley, of course, we in the story, Dorothy Eady carries on a love affair, an interdimensional love affair with Seti, who was the pharaoh who built the Temple of Seti at Abydos, where we see these amazing depictions of the Osiris device. And so the reason I'm so interested in Om Seti's story is because it shows the result of Seti's acquisition of this knowledge. He was able to do the things, toggling between the worlds, and all of the things that later Jesus does, some of these exact same things in the New Testament narrative. And what I'm suggesting here is that we have to go back and really truly understand what Seti was knew about the Osiris device, because his life is an example of the knowledge that is still there at that temple in Egypt.
As we move from Pisces into Aquarius, we become aware of a great plan in operation. Specifically, Pisces, the sign of the fish, Jesus, the fisherman, the fisher of men. He goes and he recruits his disciples among fishermen. And now we come to the end of the age of the fisherman. The fisherman is, the little fish swims peacefully in his water. He is sustained by the water. Everything he needs to live is given to him. Suddenly the water is poured out. The environment is under threat. It's collapsing in all kinds of different ways. Now we see that our world is under threat because madmen are frantically building nuclear weapons that they will detonate if they can in the heart of Western civilization. This is the process of the water being poured out, and the poor little fish, which is us, ends up on dry ground, flopping with gills that don't work on dry ground. This happened before when Aries, the ram, changed to Pisces. The result was, over the next 100 years, the entire classical world collapsed, and a new world came up in its place. This is happening again. William, what about these energies that you are working on? How can they help us now?
Well, the image of Aquarius is of the figure who is pouring out the water. And it's interesting to me that in the original Sumerian depictions, it's the god of technology, whose name was Enki, who is also portrayed in that manner with water around him. And he is sometimes thought of as the model for Aquarius. It was Enki who was opposed to his half-brother Enlil. It was Enlil who sought to keep humankind at the level of slaves and sex objects and using them as swords in battles between the gods. It was Enki who sought to uplevel the human race to the level of the gods and even to assist us in exceeding the capabilities of the gods. And so I think part of what we have to do is begin to adopt this attitude that the reason why they want to control us so desperately is because of the incredible power, the incredible godlike power that is within us. And what we've got to do is start finding those images that we can begin to reflect to one another of that power. And certainly this idea that, or this understanding that's unfolding right now of these cosmic energies that are there to assist us is one of the key revelations of our time. And I was really intrigued when we interviewed Andrew Collins recently, and I asked him, who is the author of The Cygnus Mystery, who talks about the blazer or the neutron star of Cygnus X3 that is beaming
yes.
this energy towards us that he thinks could potentially be harmful to us if it has a direct assault on us. And one of the things
but helpful to us too, in the sense that if you treat a fire correctly, it's useful. If you
that's right.
treat it badly, it's not so useful. If you sit in the flames, you're in trouble. If you heat
that's
yourself
right.
with them, you're in good shape.
And so I asked Andrew about if there's any symbols of Cygnus that he has come across in his research. And he said, yes, there's one very important one. It looks like a bird's foot. It's a three-pronged symbol that looks like a bird's foot. And those who watch my Lost Secrets of Jesus DVD will clearly see that three-pronged bird's foot symbol as the symbol emanating from the Holy Spirit, symbolized by the dove, atop the head of Mary. You even see Jesus holding three rays or spears of light in his hand in a painting by Botticelli. And so I definitely connect these three spears or three rays in the hands of Jesus in the Botticelli painting with the three rays or bird-footed shape seen coming out of the mouth of the dove in the depictions in stained glass at Chartres Cathedral of Mary. And what it suggests to me is that in both instances, it's showing awareness, first of all, of these cosmic energies, and that they, in fact, can have an enlightening effect on the human body. And that's the area where we've got to begin to focus our research, because as we do this, it's going to start to anchor this energy in our civilization. Right now, it's just kind of flying all around us and is being misdirected, if it's directed at all. But as we can begin to reach up and gather these energies in our world, there's incredible power that is there, and it won't take a whole lot of us to be able to make this awakening really start to happen and accelerate in an amazing way.
Well, I know a way to access this energy coming out of Cygnus, at least insofar as I know anything about it. And this is, in the subscriber section, there is a meditation called the Cygnus Meditation that talks about what I do know and how I have made this energy work for myself. And before we go, William, we got about 5 or 6 minutes left. I want to talk about something that's near and dear to my own heart, which I call exquisite instinct. In the distant past, people knew things. And they built technologies, but in a different way from how we do. We are working out of reason. They were working out of a kind of instinct, I think, where they were open to the meaning of the universe and the sense of the universe in the same way an animal is, but with a much, much, much larger mind than an animal's mind. And a human mind is vastly larger than an animal's mind. They were still living by instinct, but it became exquisite instinct, and that's why they built these things. And if you had asked the builders what the principles were behind them, they would have talked to you in terms of the energies that they were feeling and how to access those energies. They would not have talked to you in terms of particle physics at all, I don't think. How do you respond to that?
No, I think that's very true, that these symbols are of such an archetypal nature that they can be interpreted and reinterpreted throughout the ages, but ultimately they seem to lead to the same understanding. Like, for example, what we hope to be able to do, or at least what I hope we're going to be able to do at CERN, is reveal that new dawn, reveal the light as it's shown at the time before the first week of creation by recreating the conditions of the Big Bang. Because of our mindset, have to do it with tools and technology, but perhaps in the ancient world they had a way of intuiting it or through, as you could describe it, exquisite instinct, being able to apprehend these mysteries. And again, to me, the primary mindset that they had as they were approaching the universe is they looked at the universe and said, yes. We seem to look at the universe and say, no, no, we want to control it. We want to keep it in a way that keeps us out of fear, and we keep ourselves out of fear by turning a blind eye to it. And as I said earlier, one of the key things that we can do to balance or harmonize ourselves with the universe is simply to say yes to it and to be open to the possibilities that we have within ourselves and also the possibilities that the universe itself offers to us. I think that is really the secret that we're all looking for here.
William, and that is a great place to end Dreamland. Subscribers, do not miss this extraordinary and powerful exchange between William Henry and Anne Streber about the very energies that we're talking about. Next up on Dreamland, Linda Moulton Howe.
You're listening to Whitley Strieber's Dreamland Online.
Hi, my name is Al Harlow, and I run the UnknownCountry.com store and the subscriber section. So when you buy from us, you buy from me, personally. And I think I run a very special store. Whitley and Anne Streber have read every single book in it, and they know most of the authors personally. And that's why when I say it is, very simply, the best bookstore of its kind in the world, I can stand behind those words. And I stand behind my store, too. When you buy here, you buy from me. When you have a question or a problem, you don't get some nameless autoresponder with a canned answer. You get me. And I get you your answer. So click on that store tab right now and explore. Your mind will thank you.
Linda Moulton Howe, unique in this world, a science reporter who dares to approach our environment with an open mind. She's willing to look at the deepest of mysteries, and her website, earthfiles.com, is the very finest website of its kind in the world. Do not let your day pass without going to earthfiles.com. Linda Moulton Howe, the best there is.
Well, you were wise to wait for it, because today Linda Moulton Howe has got a quite incredible story about a crop circle right here in the United States. And you know where you can find out more about it and more about the credible and factual edge of science every day is at her fabulous website, earthfiles.com, the best of its kind in the world. Do not miss it. And now here she is from Albuquerque, Linda Moulton Howe.
Thanks, Whitley. On May 24th, I received a phone call from Jeffrey Wilson, director of the Independent Crop Circle Research Association in Ohio, telling me that the Monroe County Buzz newspaper in Madisonville, Tennessee, had a headline about a crop formation in a wheat field. Madisonville is southwest of, or a little southeast of Knoxville on the eastern end of Tennessee. I called the paper and talked to Mark Boring, co-owner and editor. He had flown over the field to take photographs with his friend Brian Graves, who is one of three patrol captains in the Monroe County Sheriff's Department. Brian Graves had first seen the nine circle pattern a week earlier on May 15th from his airplane. Mark Boring said that all of the circles were swirled counterclockwise and seemed to be laid out generally in a north, south, and east-west orientation, at least as far as the four large circles were. This is a very interesting and more complicated pattern than at first glance, because there's another set of four smaller circles that fit inside of the large circles on a different axis orientation. Mark sent me copies of aerial photographs that he had taken, and I realized that I was looking at nine circles in a pattern that I was not certain that I had ever seen before. After looking at crop formations over the past almost 20 years, and after studying symbol books, I was surprised when I could not find a matching pattern in all of the crop circle books that I have. You can see this Madisonville, Tennessee wheat pattern from the air and on the ground at my news website, earthfiles.com. At the top of the headlines page is a hot link to this Madisonville Crop Formation report. Mark Boring also told me that the nine circle pattern was only about 8 miles from the Cherokee Indians' historic capital known as Chota. I asked Mark if anyone in the region there recognized this pattern as any kind of a Cherokee symbol. And to his surprise and many others there, the answer so far is no. But I did learn that the number 9 was very important to the Cherokee. The Cherokee national flag has 9 stars in a circular pattern with 1 star at the center. In the Madisonville, Tennessee wheat formation, instead of a star at the center, there is a triangle. It's made of lines only 5 inches wide in standing wheat. The triangle's base is what faces the direction of the old Cherokee Chota capital. A memorial was constructed to honor Chota. It is a raised circle with 9 pillars engraved with the 9 animal clans in which the Cherokee divided themselves. And one of the oldest sites where archaeologists have found evidence of human occupation going back at least 9,000 years ago is called Ice House Bottom, very near the location of this 2007 Madisonville, Tennessee crop formation. Jeffrey Wilson drove all the way from Ohio to the Madisonville, Tennessee field with some of his ICCRA colleagues on May 26 to collect plant and soil samples for study and to do field studies with equipment to determine if anomalous energies had put this wheat pattern down. Jeff began in his discussion with me a summary of the test results that show unequivocally this was not made by boards or sticks or string or anything that anybody could say was man-made.
We try to concentrate on things that allow us to help to discern whether or not the formation is man-made or not. The one peer-reviewed scientific test that allows us to do that is W.C. Levin Good's node elongation analysis test, what we call the NEAT for short. My wife, Delcy, and I spent the better part of 3 or 4 days measuring more than 1,500 growth nodes on the plants to get some accurate assessment of this formation. And the formation came back statistically positive, overwhelmingly so, that there was growth node elongation in the plants. So if we only had that test and we only had done that test, we could say that the formation is authentic just based on that alone. Now, we did a whole series of other tests, and we found lots of other interesting information that also supports that. We did find expulsion cavities in the formation sample plants, and so that is another non-hoaxable effect. Always, as part of our battery of tests, we measure for radioactivity, we measure for electric field strength, we measure for magnetic field strength. We did, interestingly enough, pick up increased levels of radioactivity that were statistically significant from our control radiation readings. And we also got similar elevated levels in the electric field strength. I have not had time to look at the magnetometer data yet, so that is yet to come. But it seems that so far, all of the metered tests are coming back positive, just like the node elongation test came back positive.
Have you or anyone so far found anything that you think really matches this particular 9-circle pattern?
I don't think that anybody has come up with an exact match, but there have been a number of people that have come up with variations on the theme. A lot of people call it Celtic cross pattern. In this case, there are 2 Celtic cross patterns oriented opposite each other at 45 degrees or thereabouts. And when I start to look at trying to interpret the symbology of formations such as this, one of the things I try to do is to look at the immediate context in which the formation occurs. So in this case, we look at the landscape surrounding it, and we look at the cultural context that surrounds it, and we look for indicators to help us to understand what that symbol means. In the case of the Madisonville crop circle, one of the cultural contexts that immediately is apparent is the fact that Madisonville is in the heart of what is known as the Overhill Cherokee, in which many, many Cherokee Indian village sites and prehistoric mound sites existed and are now mostly obliterated, but we know where those places were, and archaeologists had done many salvage archaeological investigations to collect enough information about those sites that we know quite a bit about them.
And Jeff, isn't it true that where this nine circles came down in this field is not very far from the Cherokee Chota capital?
That's correct, yes. In fact, it's one of the closest of the sites. Interestingly enough, it was at some of these nearby Cherokee Indian village sites that some of the information about what this symbol may mean or what this symbol is representing, some hints of that may come from those original sites. One of the closest of the sites that existed at one time, I came across an archaeological report written in the late 1800s by the Smithsonian Institution that had photographs of some of the artifacts that came out of the excavations of the mounds of that site. One of the artifacts has depicted on it the Celtic cross pattern, and it's on what is known as a shell gorget, which archaeologists believe that people wore. These designs of shell gorgets that have been found throughout the middle part of the United States in mound-building cultures, many of these depict this Celtic cross pattern.
And at the very center of the Madisonville, Tennessee formation, where the wheat is standing, and there is a triangle in there, is the triangle pointing right at the old Chota Cherokee capital?
No, it's not. The triangle is actually, it's not an equilateral triangle. It's somewhat extended, and that may give us a hint as to the direction in which the triangle is pointing. But it seems to be pointing in almost the opposite direction. It points towards the west and not towards the east. The base of the triangle is pointing towards Chota, actually.
If you extended the point out to the west, where would you come to something that might be ancient in Cherokee or other?
That's a good question. I haven't attempted that part of the analysis yet.
Nothing exactly has emerged that has circles in which there are four large connected by corridors and then four smaller inside turned sort of 45 degrees so that they fit inside of the four larger circles.
Right. You know, it's interesting. Aside from some parallels with, say, the marks on a compass, there aren't really any patterns like this that we've managed to find. And there have been lots of Celtic cross patterns that have been reported around the world, mostly in England. And yet this particular design, as simple as it is, this particular design has never been seen before.
And if you take those arms, they are on a kind of east-west, north-south orientation, aren't they, the large circles?
Generally, they're off about 5 or 6 degrees from being north, south, east, and west.
I wonder, in Cherokee mythology, it's the north, south, east, west orientation that has always been so critical.
Well, that idea relates to the cosmological way in which the Native Americans viewed their place in the world. It has to do with an idea of quartering time and space. And that's how they viewed themselves as being at the center of things, and it was very important to them to be able to quarter time and space. And this may have something to do with that.
Can you give your personal reaction to what you were seeing on the ground in this particular formation?
Well, first of all, we got there about 10 days or 11 days after it was first seen. We don't know the exact date of the formation. We can't establish that window of time in which it may have occurred because it was spotted by somebody from an airplane, and so we don't know prior to that when it was formed. And in that amount of time, many of the plants had begun to reorient themselves back to the sun. And so the formation, in terms of the way it looked, it was a little fuzzy, so to speak. But you could tell that many of the plants had not come back up and they were still swirled down very flat. One of the things that we noticed just in walking into the different circles was that each of the circles, in terms of the way that they're swirled down, each of them are swirled down differently. What I mean by that is that they're not just swirled down from center to edge or from the edge to the center, but that the way in which the plants are laid down is flattened out in various directions.
And are they all counterclockwise?
They are all generally swirled counterclockwise. Even the triangle is swirled down counterclockwise. The plants actually made the bends of the triangle. They actually bent to make the corners of the triangle.
Mm.
And they continued around in that fashion. The standing center, which incorporates the flattened triangle, the exterior of that is a flattened ring about 45, 46 feet across. And the inner edge of that, going around towards the east, that actually flowed into the triangle to begin the triangle. And then as it reached the other two points, the weed actually made the bend and then came back to its original entry point. And those triangle pathways were only about 4 to 5 inches across. But what's important to note is that in many of these circles, the way in which that they're flattened down is different from circle to circle to circle. Mm-hmm. And the geometric centers of these circles is not where the swirled center of these circles is. They are generally off by anywhere from 1 to 3 feet away from the swirled center. But again, the detail of each one of them being swirled down differently, I think, is really interesting in the sense that it would be much more difficult for a hoaxer to pull off.
And combined with your physical data.
Yeah, well, the physical data knocks out the chance that people have hoaxed it. They just cannot hoax the expulsion cavities, or they can't elongate notes just by flattening down the wheat with a board or a garden roller, for instance. It's just not possible to do. You can test that yourself. If you want to, you can take some wheat plants or grass plants with growth notes on them and take a rolling pin and roll them flat on your countertop or your table, and you won't be able to extend out those notes. It's just not.
And the only hypothesis that is workable about how this could happen is some kind of a complex energy system that's coming down from above and interacting with the plant.
That's our best guess at this point. We see the physical, tangible evidence for some kind of energy interacting with the plants. What that is anybody's guess. Nobody knows what the source cause is at this point.
Where Madisonville is in Tennessee and its relationship both to the Cherokee history of the last 300 years, what about going back further?
Well, actually, one of the closest of the archaeological sites to where the crop circle came down is a location known as Ice House Bottom. And Ice House Bottom has had a very long history of occupation, human occupation. They've been able to get artifacts from that site that date back to at least 9,000 years before the present day, making it one of the very oldest sites in the country in terms of occupation. The general area there fits into the type of topography characteristics that we find in circle formation after circle formation here in the U.S. 95% of the crop circle formations in the U.S. follow three main characteristics. One is that they sit very close to some kind of body of water, a creek, a pond, a drainage ditch, right over the top of an aquifer, that kind of thing. In this case, the crop circle sits right over the top of limestone. There is underground water there. It's also very close to a creek and a small pond. So the water is present in this case. One of the other main characteristics is that crop circles are coming down very close to power lines. And In about 85% of the cases, the closest power line pole to the crop circle has a transformer box on it. In this case, the two closest power line poles to the crop circle both have transformer boxes on them, and the power lines are relatively close. And then the next characteristic is that the crop circle appears kind of in a low area, and this is in a valley area. There are high hills all surrounding this field where the crop circle is. So those three main characteristics, you know, seem to hold sway. The fourth main characteristic is that in about 65% of the cases, perhaps higher, the crop circle is coming down close to Native American archaeological or mound sites, and that, of course, has this in spades. So,
right.
So there are those four all close by. I would also add a couple of interesting things about this area. We have gotten a couple of stories given to us while we were down there investigating the formation of people reporting mysterious lights in the immediate area surrounding where the crop circles occurred. And in one particular circumstance, there are a series of hills to the east of where this crop circle is. They call this area the Knobs. And a couple of the people that came to visit the formation that talked with us said that the Knobs are known locally for having unusual lights seen there regularly, much like the Brown Mountain lights, for instance, in North Carolina, or the lights down in Texas, something like that, that these unusual lights seem to occur in the general area. And also, as Mark Boring pointed out in his initial article, the very last eyewitness to something known locally as the Birdman was seen just a few hundred yards away from where this crop circle occurred. Now, in discussing with Mark Boring and some other locals about what the Birdman was, he said that about 35 eyewitnesses saw this Birdman back in, the last reported sighting was in 1975, and the Birdman was about 7.5 feet tall, with a body of a man with wings like a bird, and head of a man but with a beak like a bird. And in one eyewitness case, the person actually shot at the Birdman. There also seems to be the connection with the Thunderbird and the Birdman and the Cherokee. This I found really interesting is that the Cherokee refer to themselves as being the friend of the Thunderbird.
The friends of the Thunderbird. And Whitley, when I began to Google what is there out there that is known about that name, Thunderbird, I was so surprised to find myself looking one of the Sumerian gods that was referred to as the Thunderbird, as something that came from above and was involved with Mesopotamia. And when you realize that some of that area around Madisonville, Tennessee today was occupied 9,000 years ago by some form that right now, archaeologically, it's a mystery. They have found the clay pipes in the Sype Mound up in Ohio that are exactly the same clay in the pipes that they have found in some of these ancient areas around Madisonville, Tennessee, suggesting that either there was trade or that somehow there was a common denominator to these pipes in two regions of this country. And the fact that there is this area going back 9,000 years there, that would be before the Hopewell culture in Ohio. And it made me think again that back in 1999 to 2000, when I was in England thinking very specifically about a book that I would do called Mysterious Lights and Crop Circles, and I wrote in my book, if hypothetical spinning plasma vortices are involved with crop circle creations, what unknown trigger would repeatedly produce them? Could low-energy plasmas with microwave frequencies produce the physical impacts on soil and plant and leave images of mysterious lights and spheres on videotapes and photographs? Are the mysterious lights an unidentified natural phenomenon or supervised by an advanced intelligence which humans have yet to encounter? Could the lights be connected to the same ancient intelligence which inspired other marks around the world in ziggurats, pyramids, mounds, and stone circles?
Wow, Linda, what a report. Linda, I have to tell you, and just as we're a little running overtime right now, but I will tell you that this intelligence certainly communicated with me personally. The circle of nine means it relates in my mind to the nine knocks that I experienced that I wrote about in my book Transformation. And of course, the grays, when they come in groups of three. And I have a great deal of material in Transformation, my other books, about the meaning of nine and three, which are most absolutely fundamental to the nature of this universe and our place in it. So this, to me, is an incredibly profound communication in this crop circle that also points us back once again toward the past and reminds us very forcefully that I think what you said earlier was extremely true, that we have lost our way in that we are trying to control something that we need, in fact, to surrender to, and we call it the universe. Thank you very much, Linda Moulton Howe, and folks, never miss a week of Dreamland. That would be a mistake.
This has been Whitley Strieber's Dreamland. Thanks very much for listening. We'll be back next week with another journey to the extreme edge of controversy on Dreamland. Do not miss it.